Welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks are falling in the dark. The Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly. Not as fools, but as wise. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the weird things that don't look good in the neighborhood is when it comes to Bible prophecy. You know, the Bible talks about how there's going to be a one world government, you know, Big Brother and what have you, how they're going to take over the world and what have you. And ladies and gentlemen, it looked like we are already here. But there was a movie that came out called 1984. George Orwell, he predicted back in 1949, almost, you know, 40 years before it even happened, what the world was coming to. And this is kind of like a documentary regarding that movie. So get close to your radio.
Imagine if you lived in a world where you were constantly watched. A world where everything is controlled by the elite. Where you're bombarded with non-stop propaganda. A world where everyone is repressed, lonely, and isolated. Existing as one insignificant cog in an incomprehensible machine. This is the chilling vision of the future that George Orwell put forward in his masterpiece 1984. And does it sound familiar? It's no coincidence that his predictions have come true in nearly every single way in our modern society today. So let's take a deep dive into the story of 1984 to learn how you're being controlled and if you can ever break free. Now, the movie begins with a quote from the iconic book that it was adapted from. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. And this sets the stage. And then without delay, we are then shown the iconic shot of a crowd of people staring at propaganda presented by the party. The party is the shadowy government which controls every aspect of life through their ideology INSOC. The basic principle is to control information so tightly that every aspect of life is dictated and controlled by the party. Absolute obedience is expected, down to rejecting basic facts about life and even your own thoughts and memories. On the screen, a video player is creating an idyllic image of the country that the West has become, all under this totalitarian rule, Oceania. This is one of the three superstates which make up the world of 1984, with control over the Americas, Britain, Australia, and some parts of Africa. And this is when we're introduced to the concept of Big Brother, and a man named Goldstein, who attempts to persuade the people of Oceania that they are being duped. But despite the truth in what he's saying, he's drowned out by shouts from the audience. INSOC has conditioned them to reject the truth entirely, to the point they don't even want to hear it. Throughout the demonstration, you can see the INSOC salutes, something that was borrowed from historical totalitarian regimes. And after this propaganda video reaches its climax, the crowd is pacified by the symbol of INSOC, alongside the face of Big Brother. It's afterwards that we're introduced to our main character, Winston Smith, who is working in an office cubicle for the Ministry of Truth. His job is to edit past broadcasts to reflect the current reality that they're pushing. So if the sugar ration has been reduced from last year, he will then edit last year's paper to imply that it actually went up instead. And then once he's finished with his day's work, Winston makes his way back home, where propaganda is already being played in his house. This time it's a man being shamed for falling under Goldstein's influence. The man has been charged for attempting to persuade the public that they're not at a war with Eurasia, but rather East Asia. This information control on Eurasia is central to Big Brother's control of the people, as over time, the party has rewritten reality to suit their needs. Now, Winston is a key part of this process, but obviously this brings up contradictions, and that's where the concept of doublethink comes in, the idea of wholeheartedly believing in two separate contradictory facts. One of the examples they give in the novel is the simultaneous belief that the party is a bastion of democracy, and also that democracy is impossible, and it's through this concept that the party rewrites reality, replacing it with an illusion of their own creation. And this is the all-encompassing lie that maintains 1984 society. It's only through everyone believing it that it becomes real. But this concept of a world founded on fiction isn't something that Orwell created all by himself. Instead, this is something that's very real and has been observed throughout history. Thousands of years ago, Plato wrote some of the first recorded philosophy on this concept, through what he called the noble lie, where people know their place in society through their belief in an entirely fictional story about the society's origin. The details aren't important, so long as it gives justification for the social order. And this gives people a reason to accept how the world is, and that their equal man is somehow better or worse than him. And we see this today, when our own version of Big Brother says one thing and then means another. Like when the establishment media, politicians, and World Economic Forum claim to be working for freedom and free speech, also while doing everything they can to bully and censor all criticism into silence. And there are just countless examples of this, like when the fattest, most grotesque politicians of them all claim that they're promoting health. And this concept has evolved over time as people realize that all of society's institutions are built upon a necessary fiction, and this is known as the habitus. It's the veil you need to see through for society to make sense. Now, the concept is similar to the noble lie, but the habitus goes much deeper. You see, throughout your life, you are influenced by your environment and your interactions with other people, and these combined with your personality create your view of the world, and it's in this way that you buy into the habitus, the shared societal illusion of how the world should be. You are socialized into the habitus. It's come down from above, and everyone else around you believes in it. The habitus is the social contract between you, your fellow man, and the government, and it's what determines your culture. It's what determines all the societal trends around you, and therefore also decides the rules of society. And this stretches to everything: our ideas of beauty, what's seen as valuable, what's seen as even right and wrong. But because it's influenced by the environment and how people treat each other, the habitus is always changing to reflect this. And the world of 1984 operates on a habitus. The problem with the 1984 habitus is that it's been cracked at the top and severely deformed. And because it's been poisoned at the top, it's trickled down into all elements of society. And this is why 1984 is so scary. In fact, 1984 is far more unsettling than any dumb horror film because it's so realistic. We all instinctively know what the future could be like because we're so close to it today. Our society that we live in right now is just a few steps away from totalitarianism. And Orwell was trying to warn us of all of this. Because throughout the story, we're gonna see exactly how the party has warped the habitus and society, and how it's affected everyone within the society. So getting straight back into the story, and we see Winston sitting alone in his decrepit apartment, and it's here after lighting a cigarette that Winston introduces us to the concept of thought crime. Now, thought crime is the act of going against the habitus of the world, even in your deepest thoughts. Just considering rebellion is already rebellion, because it's something outside of the party's reality. The party enforces this through the Thought Police, a secret organization which uses informants, surveillance, and undercover agents to root out anyone who even thinks about rebelling. And as the propaganda continues playing in the background on the ever-present screen, Winston lifts a brick from his house and uncovers his journal, something that's definitely banned in the world he lives in. And it's in this journal that Winston reminisces about a world where thought was free, a time where minds weren't controlled by Big Brother and the Thought Police. And by doing this, he's already become a thought criminal just through his own memories. And upon waking up the next day, Winston is then subjected to a mandatory exercise routine in front of his television, to which he is signaled out for not performing adequately. Winston then half-heartedly waves the in-sock hand signal and makes his way to work. And that's when he's treated to even more propaganda playing on the television during lunch hour. However, what instead catches the eye of Winston is a young woman staring at him. Winston then sits down and begins eating his meal, when one of his colleagues comments on the new shortened dictionary and how positive the destructions of word really is. Newspeak, as they call it, is a new language invented by the party that reduces English to its bare essentials, where controversial words are removed, meaning that if it works, then rebelling will be impossible, because it won't even be able to be considered. The words just won't exist for it. Back at work, Winston then continues his job at the Ministry of Truth, this time unpersoning someone. Now, unpersoning is the act of essentially removing someone from history and replacing them with someone else. And this is just one of the many aspects of 1984, which has its roots in previous autocracies. Now, in this, Orwell was specifically alluding to Stalin's dictatorship, where this was an extremely common practice. Enemies of the state, or rather enemies of Stalin, wouldn't just be executed. Every mention of their name and even their image in photographs was erased, completely removing them from history. However, this practice, of course, hasn't died out. The Chinese government, for example, was infamous for disappearing anyone they don't like. Jack Ma, the CEO of Alibaba, essentially disappeared from public view after making economic suggestions that would shift power away from the Chinese Communist Party. And today, he's all but vanished from the public eye, spending his time in exile under constant surveillance. But we're not just talking about China. This is happening all over the West. When anyone who speaks out against the agenda set in place by Western governments, they are then often censored or bullied into silence. Whether it be Julian Assange or Edward Snowden talking about the government's crimes, or any other supposed thought criminal who's been cancelled on social media for talking about COVID and its origins. Anything deemed a thought crime and you can be cancelled immediately. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where FBI and other government intelligence agencies are infiltrating and working in conjunction with all the big social media sites. And once they have control of sites like Twitter, they can then censor any narrative they don't like, shadow banning or completely deleting people from the sites. But it's not just social media companies. Now even companies like Uber, PayPal, and even Airbnb can ban you for having the wrong opinions online. And then over in China is their infamous social credit system. The basic idea is for each person to be assigned a personal score based on how trustworthy they are according to the Chinese government. Certain things can increase your score, like making a social media post praising the government. But on the other hand, things like getting into debt, buying too many video games, reading the Bible, or criticizing the government deducts points from your score. And if your score falls too low, the CCP will then severely reduce your already restricted freedoms, as people with a low score can have trouble buying train or even plane tickets. Some people have even had their pets taken away from them, with one student even being denied a place at university because his father had a low score. For now, the system is only being put into practice by some scattered regional governments, but it won't be that way for very long. And recently, Xi Jinping being pushed through new laws to lay the groundwork, meaning that a nationwide social credit system is just a few years away. I mean, recently it's gotten so bad in China that a new law just passed, which means that farmers can only plant the crops the government approves of. And the personal planting of vegetables like beans, melons, squashes in your front or backyard is now strictly forbidden. And in the West, we're also seeing a gradual progression of repression, which is exactly what George Orwell feared. So after he finishes with his work for the day, Winston makes his way to an antique store in the slum districts of London and meets the owner who sold him his journal. He buys a coral figurine, taped with glass, and makes his way out of the store, where he meets the same woman who was staring at him during lunch. The woman continues looking at him ominously, going into the proletariat zones in London, something that is forbidden by the party. She could sell him out, and so Winston considers killing her back at his apartment. Coincidentally enough though, the two see each other the very next day in an underpass. The woman stumbles and falls to the ground, but quickly makes her way back on her feet. Secretly, as he's helping her, the woman hands Winston a note before leaving. At work, Winston unveils the note, and it reads, "I love you," along with a meetup location on the backside. Seemingly without a second thought, Winston tosses the note into the incinerator, and we transition back to his apartment, where Winston is fixing his neighbor's drain at the behest of his neighbor's wife. At the apartment, one of the neighbor's children loudly accuses him of being a thought criminal. Obviously, this makes Winston very nervous. It's an accusation which can lead to death and suffering, and it's coincidentally true. But both of the adults ignore it. It's just the result of youth indoctrination. However, it's true all the same. Luckily, before the confrontation can go any further though, a news flash interrupts the engagement. The announcement states that the war with Eurasia is reaching an end. But with how the flow of information works in a totalitarian state, who can really say if this is the case? And it's afterwards we see a mob of citizens cheering on executions playing from the television, along with a bunch of Eurasian prisoners being escorted to their impending death. Winston is among this crowd, along with a mysterious woman who hands Winston another note. She is relying on him to destroy it. Winston abides and says that he will finally meet her at the drop point, taking a train to the destination. On the train ride, a band of children are then singing a propaganda song, where they pledge loyal devotion to the state and to die with dignity. And it's in these two scenes where we see a worrying aspect of the world in 1984. The party only came to power just a few decades ago, but the new generation of completely indoctrinated children is already approaching adulthood. In the novel, Winston notes that the children are the most dogmatic and fanatic supporters of Big Brother. Growing up in the system means their habitus is completely under the control of government. One day, the last people who can remember the old war like Winston will will die, leaving no one left who knows anything outside of the state's control. A truly terrifying thought. And so once Winston exits on a stop, we see our first glimpse of nature in the movie. This change of scenery is a stark contrast to the industrial environment that the majority of Oceania presides in. Winston is now out in the forest and looking for the drop point, until he hears a twig snap behind him. It's the woman, and she has been following him the whole time. When the two get to a scheduled hiding place, it's here where we get an insight into Winston's worldview. After learning that the woman has done this exact stunt with hundreds of men, Winston states that he hates goodness and doesn't want virtue to exist anywhere.
I hate purity. I hate goodness. I don't want virtue to exist anywhere. I want everyone corrupt.
Well, I ought to suit you then.
Winston wants everyone corrupted, much to the delight of the women. This state of mind is a direct response to the tyranny of Winston's society, meaning that everything the party and the habitus sees as good is turned on its head. And because of this overwhelming level of control in the society, all Winston really wants to do is yell bullshit at all the lies slung at him. But most of the things that Winston thinks are bad or corrupted just aren't. They're normal parts of life which the party sees as a threat to their authority, and therefore it's outlawed. It's part of the tactic of keeping the people impoverished and uneducated, as this makes them far easier to control. Because real education and economic prosperity are the two worst things for Big Brother. As they're not trying to enlighten you or save your soul, it's all about control. The more you commit to their ideology, the more they can poison your soul. And that's why in the book Orwell writes, every record has been destroyed or failed, every book rewritten, every picture repainted, every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. And today in our own world, we're seeing a very similar process unfold. You see, things as simple as children's books, I'm talking Roald Dahl books, are now being pushed through a demented purity filter, where all bad words or paragraphs are now being rewritten. Words like witches have been turned to hags, fat turned to ginormous, black person to dark, cloud men to cloud people. Entire sections of these children's books are being rewritten to eliminate any wrongthink. And this isn't just children's books. This is happening throughout all genres. Roald Dahl is just the most egregious example of this. But it doesn't even stop there, because even a recent UK government-backed report has now claimed that reading George Orwell's 1984 is a sign of, quote, extremism. So Western governments are now characterizing people who read 1984 as potential enemies of the state. And this isn't just happening with words, we're also seeing this in the same form of economic control. As we're all familiar with, the past few decades have seen enormous inequality that has steadily risen over the last 40 years, which is why by 2019, the world's richest 26 people earned more wealth than the poorest 50%. But then after COVID, the biggest wealth transfer in history occurred. Now to put into scale how big this wealth transfer truly was, we have to look at the stats. In early 2020, before COVID began, billionaires alone as just people owned 2% of total global wealth. And this is only including publicly available information. But just a year later, and this number was now 3.5%. 1.5% more of the total global wealth has gone to just billionaires alone, all in a single year. And the result of this is ginormous wealth for the top elites and a never-ending hamster wheel for the masses, where you can never control your own money, where you never own anything, where you have no property, land, or assets, or even any prospect of owning these things in the future, just continually renting everything with nothing to your name. Because in the last couple years, as wages have stagnated, the cost of everything around you has gone up exponentially, only continuing to go up and up while your income starts to shrink. And so it was no surprise that as this great wealth transfer unfolded, the World Economic Forum unveiled their new plan, the Great Reset. Now for those of you unaware, the World Economic Forum is a priestly caste of people, mixed up of global leaders, royal families, BlackRock, the world's biggest companies, the biggest banks, the biggest pharmaceutical companies, mainstream media outlets, and the top celebrities. Pretty much a culmination of the world's most powerful people. And these are the people who create agendas and policies that are then adopted by organizations such as the UN, World Bank, IMF, and national governments. And this private organization has no democratic vote, and yet it is quite clearly one of the most powerful organizations the world has ever seen, not just affecting the West, but also Russia and China. So when they unveiled their plan for a Great Reset, this marked a new chapter in human history, and the leader of this organization is Klaus Schwab, who claimed the Great Reset would provide a unique window of opportunity to reshape our world.
And I see the need for action, I see the need for a Great Reset.
And one part of this agenda was to make the world greener, more carbon neutral, which sounds great, but what exactly did he mean by this? Well, as you might have noticed, all governments in the West in just the last year have promoted these policies heavily, with the West now being forced to cut their ammonium and nitrogen emissions by 50% alone. However, for many farmers in Europe, their livestock normally produce ammonia and urine and feces, and so farmers all across Europe were recently forced to cut 30% of their livestock, which meant huge swaths of farmers were forced out of business by the government. And yet these same rules never applied for sectors like the airline industry. So suddenly, farmers and workers across Europe protested. But at first, these protests were smeared as just crazy right-wingers. But as this resentment grew and the protests gripped European nations, the government acted harshly, with live rounds being fired upon these protesters. I mean, in the Netherlands, they even changed the law that officers who killed protesters were now immune from manslaughter charges. And whilst the media covered this up, the Dutch government would never receive any backlash, as they were cowering to the World Economic Forum orders. And the working class people in Europe were forced to see their future destroyed before them, as they were attacked and mocked in the media. And so it was no surprise that around this period, Klaus Schwab, the leader of the World Economic Forum, warned of increasing anger.
We have to prepare for a more angry world.
Because Western governments were now forcing the food supply to run dry, whilst artificially inflating the prices amidst a global food shortage, only deepening the economic crisis that the majority of the West were facing. And in an act of doublethink, something that came straight out of 1984, media outlets like Reuters would then claim that there was no evidence that the Dutch government worked with the World Economic Forum to impose these new laws, which really isn't all that surprising given the World Economic Forum partnered with Reuters for exclusive content distribution, as the World Economic Forum, otherwise known as Big Brother, controls the flow of information. And whilst you might not see the anger in the news, these protests haven't stopped in Europe. I mean, just recently, protests have gripped the country of France, as the President Macron has risen the pension age, meaning it's going to take longer and longer before workers can ever receive a pension. Even though the majority of France hates this idea, this was imposed anyway, as democracy in Western nations is becoming a facade. In fact, democracies aren't even obeying the people anymore. They obey corporate and financial interests rather than the popular vote, the World Economic Forum over the people. And that's why our freedoms are slowly being stripped economically and socially. Because if everyone had social and economic freedom, then the whole system would collapse. And instead of new parties emerging and addressing these protests, you're now seeing the militarization of the police, more surveillance, more distraction. And it's following this agenda that people like Bill Gates are claiming at the World Economic Forum that during our current worst cost of living crisis and the ongoing fuel shortages, Bill thinks that workers should now also be paying carbon taxes, whilst people like Bill Gates are using the most carbon of all. They'll preach things like private property for the average person will be a bygone relic, all while snapping up record amounts of farmland across the US, following their mantra of you'll own nothing and be happy. And all you're left with is again more distraction, more noise, more misery, more tension and more depression. No more family units, less farms, less freedoms, and no more rights to pursue happiness. And this is just one of the reasons our habitus has been violently shifted towards consumerism and hollow material wealth, because we're being starved of it, and it's the perfect means to keep control in society. But how did things ever get this bad? This has never really happened in living memory. Well, what Orwell didn't foresee was that pleasure was just as useful a tool to keep the masses numbed. You see, as they slowly siphon the wealth out of the economy, the elites keep us distracted with hollow, empty hedonism. And modern technology is the perfect tools for this. By exploiting the basic social need to be accepted, social media applications exploit your dopamine receptors in the exact same way as cocaine. Years of split testing, perfecting the algorithms, and billions of dollars in research have made big tech companies like Facebook and TikTok as addictive as possible. And as people build up a tolerance, they always need more content faster to stay engaged, all while procrastinating and wasting their life away, being numbed into flaccid apathy in their bedrooms. The rise of TikTok, YouTube Shorts, and all these other short-form social media sites is just a direct result of this process. It's why we're developing parasocial relationships with streamers and not our own communities, giving the people the illusion of community and knowing what's going on in the world, all without any real substance or true information, and by providing a drip-drip of anodyne lethargic dross. The meaning in your life is sucked away. The resentment you feel of the government is numbed and repressed inside of you, and so you accept it. And anytime you feel depressed, isolated, like things are just outside of your control, there's always that little dopamine fix just sitting in your pocket, pushing people more and more into the online realms, stuck alone in your bedroom. And the result of this is what you see today, the most depressed and downtrodden generation in living memory. As the normal societal habitus is breaking down, it's taking away your motivation to go out in the world and make something of yourself. You don't have the energy to call out bullshit against your government and the people preaching their agenda. Responsibility, duty, purpose, these key pillars that have motivated motivated men for millennia have all been pushed out of the societal framework. Instead, consumerism and greed are the only things to look up to now. But the worst aspect of this is the effect it's had on people's relationships with each other. I mean, our current habitus right now is leaving 63% of men under age 30 single and alone, and a large majority of them aren't dating at all. Millions of men are experiencing the exact same lovelessness that Winston's known his entire life up until now. But before we continue,
Alright, we're going to stop the tape right there today. But we'll pick up there tomorrow, and we do want to apologize for his, that bad word that he used there. Alright, thank you for joining us. Listen to us all day long. We're in your corner right here on Ghostbusters.